The First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution guarantees freedom for religion, freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, and freedom to complain to the government. But how does that play out when it comes to issues of race? We look at race, civility, and the First Amendment today on the West Side. Good morning, I'm Dean Kallenbach. That subject, race, civility, and the First Amendment, was the topic of a panel discussion that was part of Monday's Chippewa Valley Martin Luther King Day virtual program, sponsored by Uniting Bridges, the Pablo Center at the Confluence, Converge Radio, UW Eau Claire, UW Stout, Chippewa Valley Technical College, and the cities of Altoona and Eau Claire. Today we feature excerpts from that conversation, so since we're presenting recorded material today, we won't be able to share calls or emails. The panelists include Timothy Scheel, UW Stout Philosophy Professor, Eric Casper, UW Eau Claire Political Science Professor, Lynette McNeely, Chair of Legal Redress for the NAACP in Wisconsin, and Josh Call, Wisconsin's Attorney General. Each panelist presented opening thoughts about the topic of race, civility, and the First Amendment, and the first to do so was Attorney General Josh Call.
I wanted to start out by talking about a couple issues that address this topic that have been in the news recently and that have gotten a lot of attention over the last several months. And one of them is an issue that I think we frequently associate with the First Amendment. And one is an issue that has significant First Amendment implications, but I think is thought of less in the context of the First Amendment, but I think it's important that we do. So the first issue is protests and policing and public safety around protests. That has certainly been the topic of a lot of attention since this past summer. And I think it's an important topic for us to address. One thing I think it's important to note as a starting point is that this is a topic that in a lot of ways, I think, has been underexplored. There is not a lot, if you look, there's not a lot of best practice guidance for how it is that we should make sure that protest activity is able to happen and that people are able to exercise their First Amendment rights to protest. Yet it's also done in a way where we're making sure that we protect public safety, we protect against destruction of property, and we protect against potential incitement to violence. Now, there are certainly clear examples where I think we would all, or hopefully all of us, would agree where there has either been an over-response or an under-response. I'll point to two examples. One is in Lafayette Square this past summer, the president famously walked across the street. He posed for a photo op, and there was at the president's direction, force used against protesters who, by all accounts, were peaceful, who were lawfully exercising their rights to protest and were doing it in a way that did not infringe upon the rights of others. We also saw very much the reverse of that about a week and a half ago in Washington, D.C., when the president and others, including Rudy Giuliani and the president's son, spoke to a group of the president's supporters in Washington, D.C., and there was what I regarded as an incitement to violence that was followed by the storming of the United States Capitol. In that case, it's clear that the Capitol Police did not expect the kind of response to that protest and the president's remarks that we saw, and there was, from my perspective, an under-response from law enforcement initially to prepare for that event. So there are extreme cases where I think we all can agree that certain actions should have been taken differently. But then there are a whole bunch of other cases that fall into a grayer area. And how is it that we go about making sure that if there are two or three people in a group of hundreds who might throw rocks at people, who might engage in looting or destruction of property, how do we police those protests when there are events like that happening where the vast majority of people are protesting peacefully and exercising their rights, but there are some people in a crowd who are not? Certainly, if you can identify those people and take action, that's the easy response. But in a lot of cases, that's not the reality. In a lot of cases, it's an evolving situation where a bottle filled with some substance might be thrown in the direction of law enforcement officers, and they don't know what's in there. So what is the appropriate response in that circumstance? This is a topic that really deserves a lot of attention, because what we've seen is people responding quickly, acting in response to events that are evolving. But it needs to have thought from leaders, both constitutional experts, activists, law enforcement leaders, so we can discuss ways that people can expect law enforcement to respond to protests, and that we make sure are protecting people's First Amendment rights to protest, so there's not engagement from law enforcement where they're not anticipating it. I am hopeful that one thing we will see from the new Biden administration's Justice Department is an effort to provide best practices, to work with stakeholders who protest, who respond to protests, who want to support constitutional rights, so that we can identify some best practices in this area. I think that's a very rich topic for further discussion, and that's one that I wanted to raise today. The second one, as I mentioned, is one that we don't always think of as a First Amendment issue, and that is our right to vote. The right to vote has an unusual history in our Constitution. You know, there were actually provisions that provided for senators to be elected not directly initially in our Constitution. But there have been several amendments to the Constitution that have changed the way that our right to vote works. That includes the 15th Amendment, which prevents discrimination based on race in voting, the 19th Amendment, which extended the right to vote to women, the 24th Amendment, which prevents poll taxes, and the 26th Amendment, which extended the right to vote to 18-year-olds. But, you know, I would ask the question, what is a more significant, fundamental, expressive activity that we engage in a democracy than our right to vote? To me, that is at the core of our First Amendment rights. And that's a right that the U.S. Supreme Court has recognized as one of our, one aspect of our First Amendment rights. There is a test that courts apply when the right to vote is burdened, and they look to both the First Amendment and the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment to figure out if the burden on the right to vote outweighs the benefits to the state or to the federal government from imposing the procedure that's been imposed. But what we've seen in the last few months is a concerted attempt to overturn the will of the voters in several states, including here in Wisconsin. I think that one of the things that needs to be a critical priority project going forward is to strengthen our protection of the right to vote, both in our Constitution and in our statutes. There is no provision in the Constitution that expressly provides for a right to vote. I think there should be, so that there is no question that when voters have rendered their decision, a state legislature can't come in and overturn the will of the voters. That was one of the things we saw litigated in this most recent election, but I think we need to be very clear about that in our Constitution. I also think it is long past time to pass the Voting Rights Advancement Act to make sure that we are protecting against discriminatory impacts from voting legislation, so that we all have a right to vote on equal terms and that equality of opportunity at the ballot box is protected. And then a third area where I think it's critical that we take action, and this is not meant to be exhaustive, by the way, but a third area is when it comes to partisan gerrymandering. We have a major imperfection in our democracy in that our elected leaders, in a lot of cases, are able to select who is going to be voting on their races. And what that has led to in state legislatures in particular, and to some extent in Congress, is representation that doesn't actually reflect the views of the voters in a state or in a region. We need to address that to make sure that our democracy is working more effectively. There are steps that can be taken at both the federal level and the state level. But by making sure that we are fortifying our democracy against those who would overturn the will of the voters or those who would try to manipulate district lines to reduce the impact that voters have in ultimately selecting the direction we take as a state and as a country, we can help empower people and make their First Amendment rights both to express themselves at the ballot box stronger, but also make sure that the impact they're having when they exercise their right to express themselves is stronger.
That's Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call. Next up on the panel was another attorney, Lynette McNeely. She's chair of legal redress for the Wisconsin Conference of the NAACP.
We have the opportunity to get the feedback on how we're doing, right? We have these amazing things in our country, these civil rights and civil liberties. And it's an opportunity for every citizen to enjoy protection with their written, verbal, and other communication. They can have the freedom to religion, to petition the government. We have the best gig in town called America, United States of America. Unfortunately, not all individuals are having an easy time at accessing those privileges. So the NAACP, which was born in, I believe, 1909, which is what it says behind me, so I remembered that, it was put in place shortly after Plessy versus Ferguson's decision in 1895, which was the 1896, right? Great.
Sorry.
No, right. Well, they had argument. Well, you know.
Yeah, I got you.
The problem there was there was a reinstantiation of Jim Crow in this country, of course. And yeah, correct me if I don't have it all. But and the problem there was African Americans had been born, raised, gone to Harvard, and got a PhD, and graduated, and lived in great communities, all as free persons. And then Jim Crow came in and took away a lot of privileges to African Americans in this country, and it just continued on for the next, you know, 100 or so years. And this was in addition to the Black Codes, of course, right? That initiative came out of the South after slavery and were basically a precursor to our Jim Crow laws, but it wasn't as prophylactically applied in the South as what occurred after the Plessy versus Ferguson decision. So we had organizations like the NAACP to remind America of the fact that there are African-Americans here who are citizens, who are contributing, finding positive ways to address the system, to fight the system, to address lynching, to encourage our government to make the right decision, to encourage our communities to make the right decisions. And we've been in place for all these years. And unfortunately, we still have to act today. The thing that I wanted to talk about when I heard about our topic today was the history, as I mentioned, of America and why we exist as an organization. But more importantly, the other side of that, why did we have to exist? The Confederacy and what it really represents, I think, has gone under the radar to some extent. Why did half the country want to separate from the Union? And having clear understanding of the values that were represented with that separation, I think it's key to understanding what's happening perhaps right now and what's happened ever since the emancipation. And there's a force in this country that is looking to deny access to Black and Brown communities, access to the American dream. That's to put it simply, without all the legal jargon. Whether it's to vote, whether it's to have a good paying job, whether it's to live in communities of your choosing, whether to bank wherever you want to. I mean, every facet of our life in this country has had some opposition by this Confederate perspective, where there's no Negro entitled to be respected by white men, or the fact that a lot of people believe that you have to be vigilant and active in denying people access to the privileges of this country. And so I think as we talk today, acknowledging that history and understanding how it's being brought forward when we have a Confederate flag being flown right in the middle of our Capitol is going to be key. But it also helps us understand why there's such vitriol today. When you have a group of people who were separating from this country and fighting and dying for slavery, to maintain slavery, to maintain the wealth that they received from slavery. And then afterwards, being active in guerrilla warfare, if you will, to attack the people who were liberated by the emancipation, to attack all of their access to the privileges of the community, we get an understanding of why we're talking about this in 2021. And when we can be honest about that as a country, I think we can start healing and moving forward and beyond. And so that's what the NAACP is looking to encourage in the state of Wisconsin. We're very proud of the work that you all are doing today and bringing this to light. And I think that will help reinforce some of the values that and the efforts that we've heard from the Attorney General today, explaining what we're looking to do in Wisconsin and to open up access. It's going to be a lot easier if we can acknowledge some of those prohibitions that have been put in place such a long time ago, those attitudes. Now, granted, there may be a freedom to have a perspective or of hate, but as we see that legacy of history is something that is creating more of a clear and present danger and the hate being displayed today. Now, my argument would have had less weight if we hadn't had the incident on January 6th. So if we could talk more about that today and seeing those two connections, I think that's going to help us heal and move on and actually realize the America that we've been striving for.
That's the voice of attorney Lynette McNeely, who is chair of legal redress of the NAACP's Wisconsin Conference. Today on the West Side, we're sharing excerpts from Monday's panel discussion on race, civility, and the First Amendment that was part of the Chippewa Valley's Martin Luther King Day program. Coming up, we'll hear opening statements from Eric Casper of UW-Eau Claire and Timothy Scheel of UW-Stout. I'm Dean Kallenbeck, and you're listening to the West Side on the Ideas Network. Today on the West Side, we're taking in excerpts from a panel discussion on race, civility, and the First Amendment from Monday's Martin Luther King Remembrance in the Chippewa Valley. Next, we hear from Eric Casper. He's a political science professor at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire and director of the school's Menard Center for Constitutional Studies.
Part of what I just want to touch on here at the outset is just getting us into some topics that I'm sure we'll get into in more detail as we go along. Here this afternoon, which are some of these specific aspects of the First Amendment, the freedom of expression. And I think it's within the light of one of the most famous lines from Dr. King's letter from the Birmingham jail, where he talks about how injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. How do you call attention to injustices? You speak out about them is one of the first steps in that regard, calling attention to them using that freedom of expression, using that ability to assemble, to have demonstrations, to have boycotts, to engage in that type of First Amendment activity. With regard to the First Amendment and what we see as far as some of the developments from the U.S. Supreme Court over time, as far as what's protected in that regard and what isn't. In particular, we're looking here within this context, I think, at most importantly, the ability to speak and assemble in traditional public forums, places that have since a very long time ago been where people generally will congregate to have these types of activities, sidewalks along public streets, public parks, these types of places. Within that area, there's a very high level of protection that's there. But of course, there are examples of things that are not protected, right? Incitement to imminent lawless action the types of things that someone might say to get a crowd to the point where they are going to engage in that type of illegal activity. Even that speech, though, is protected to up until that point where you have an actual imminent threat of lawless action that the speaker intends to have people engage in or to direct people toward engaging in. And of course, along with imminent lawless action, there are other examples of property damage resorting to violence that obviously would not be protected speech, and true threats are not protected expression. A number of other things are, though, including offensive speech. If you ever are in the situation that I'm in, you get to teach undergrads about the First Amendment. It's, of course, a very famous case of Cohen versus California, which they all enjoy because they get to, you know, use they get to use the F word in class in an academic sense. What he ended up doing is he put that word on the back of his jacket. He was in the corridors of the L.A. County Courthouse, and the U.S. Supreme Court overturned his conviction, saying that that type of expression, even though it may be seen as offensive to some, you know, there's this aspect there of being able to use language to as far as the emotive impact of language and stirring people to emotion. And so there's quite a bit of different types of expression that are protected, obviously, some that are not. But there's I think, in particular in this time that we're in now, I think if we're talking about people's ability to express themselves, there's a question of what's protected by the First Amendment. And then there's that question of what's going to be the best expression to engage in. Because this is a difficult time, and it has been a difficult time, obviously, for a while, with respect to not only some of the longstanding injustices, but additional pressures that people have been under due to the pandemic, and then, of course, what we've seen over the last few months, over the last couple of weeks. And so there's that question of how to best exercise that freedom of speech to be able to call attention to an injustice, to be able to bring people to your cause, and to do it effectively in a way that's going to bring people together in a way that's going to be productive. And I think that has to be a part of the conversation here as well, not just what's protected by the First Amendment, but how can we best exercise those First Amendment rights to really make that lasting change that we want to see to bring justice to the world.
That's UW Eau Claire political scientist Eric Casper. The final panelist to share an opening statement was Timothy Scheel. He's a philosophy professor at UW Stout and author of the 2019 book, African Americans and the First Amendment.
There's a lot to agree with in what I've heard from our panelists so far. And I'm going to flip my script from what I had planned and go in a little bit different direction to connect a little bit with the themes we're hearing and raise a few new ideas. So I think on Martin Luther King Jr. Day of Remembrance, it's really important to talk about the role race played in shaping the modern First Amendment. The modern First Amendment is to a substantial degree shaped by protest and other, you know, boycotts and other dimensions of the exercise of free speech in the United States. There's so many cases we could go back to, and a lot of this, of course, comes from the work of the civil rights heroes, including Dr. King, but it goes back long before that. 1937, a very important but neglected case, Herndon v. Lowry, an African-American labor organizer who managed to organize a biracial march to the Capitol to demand better working conditions. And it was the era of the Depression, you know, relief for workers and ordinary citizens. Well, you didn't allow in Atlanta, Georgia, such a thing to occur without finding out who organized that and going after him. They found out it was Angelo Herndon, and he was prosecuted for incitement to insurrection. It took two Supreme Court trials to get him off. 1937, Herndon v. Lowry, a black communist's expression was protected by the Supreme Court. That's shocking. 1937. Black communist speech is protected. Why? Because the court was starting to realize that the norms regarding free speech had to change, and in particular regarding the silencing of people of color. Now, we're still working on that here in 2021. The job is far from over. It's a long haul. But shout out here to NAACP, the organization more than any other than perhaps the ACLU, responsible for shaping modern First Amendment law, and in particular Thurgood Marshall, who was their legal director, won something like 29 of 32 cases in front of the Supreme Court. That's amazing. 29 out of 32 cases he argued before the Supreme Court he won. Many of them, most of them involving some sort of expression issue. Wow, I need to wrap up here. So I think it's important for us all to remember in the current era where a lot of people are calling for relaxing some protections for free speech in the belief that somehow this will help racial progress and progress towards equality. I think we need to remember that robust protections for free speech are really essential to the push for racial equality, and weakening protections for free speech will ultimately work against our demands for racial equality and the forms of protest and boycott necessary to push and demand for those sorts of changes. I would just add one last point to follow up on something Professor Casper was talking about, and that is there's some easy cases in the law. Clearly this was incitement, and there's hard cases. Maybe this was not incitement. The way we use a lot of terms in ordinary language, what is a threat, what is incitement, is not the standard in the law. So when we get into those discussions, it's really important to have legal experts weigh in on, well, okay, what is the three-prong test for incitement? How has that actually been used in cases that come before the Supreme Court? What actually are the tests for true threats, and what are cases that actually address that? So that we move away from kind of loose, ordinary, everyday expressions, which don't really have any legal force, but and may lead people in misdirections and may in itself be a kind of misinformation.
That's UW Stout Professor Timothy Scheel during his opening statement at Monday's panel discussion on race, civility, and the First Amendment. Teresa O'Halloran, the interim vice chancellor for equity, diversity, and inclusion at UW-Eau Claire, after the opening statements we just heard, shared out the first question for the panel.
Yeah, well, the first one that was thrown to us was by our leader in this whole day, Salika Duxworth-Lawton, is wondering if we can talk a little bit more about kind of the line between protected and unprotected speech. I think Professor Scheel was alluding to that a little bit in his comments of, you know, Woods, some loosening of the protections or some reduction of the protections of the free speech laws lead to protection of certain groups of people. I don't know if you wanted to dig into that a little bit, Professor Scheel, a little bit more with the what's protected, what's not protected.
Oh, wow. We could really go a long time for that one. But partly the issue is First Amendment law is one of the most doctrinally sophisticated areas of the law there are. There are tests for obscenity, there's tests for threats, there's tests for incitement, there's so many tests. Then you throw in time, place, manner stuff. It's super complicated in one sense, and maybe not so complicated in another sense. In the uncomplicated sense, I think what we would want to say is, the default position is government shouldn't interfere with people's expression. That should be the default position. Government should only step in to interfere if there's some really compelling reason, and we're avoiding the issues of overbreadth, you know, laws that encompass too many things or laws that are unduly vague. You know, they can be interpreted in arbitrary and unfair ways by judges or juries. So, you know, you get to the topic that everyone wants to get at now, you know, the incitement issue with President Trump's remarks. And we have legal experts beyond the level I'm at that can comment, you know, more specifically on that. But I mean, as I understand it, there's three tests that have to be met for it to qualify as incitement to imminent lawlessness. And one is the speaker has to have the intent to do so. Number two, they have to use the right kinds of expression that constitute incitement. And then there has to be the imminence part. There has to be proximity between their expression and intention and the violence occurring or likely to occur.
Let's take it over to the two attorneys. Let's start with Attorney General Carl.
I think the professor has provided a really great overview of some of the legal issues that frame how we analyze these First Amendment questions in their introductory remarks and in Professor Shields' recent remarks. I'll just follow that up with, I guess, a few issues that I think are ones that are of interest and that are going to become really challenging issues in the time ahead. You know, one thing that is fairly extraordinary about President Trump's remarks is that they are coming from the President of the United States. And, you know, incitement cases don't arise in the context of the President of the United States in inciting cases. And one of the things that I think could be a big issue in his impeachment trial is, you know, is the standard under the First Amendment for where we draw the line, is that different from the standard we use in deciding whether somebody's conduct as president has so crossed the line that impeachment is appropriate? But it also touches on, I think, related issues, which are, you know, there has been a lot of disinformation on the internet. We saw in 2016 with foreign actors attempting to use bots and other forms of disinformation. And generally speaking, you are allowed to say something even if it's not true. It's protected by our First Amendment, subject to certain limitations. But how do we deal with it when that's being used as a means for foreign countries to try to undermine our ability to govern and undermine the stability of the US? I think that's a really challenging issue. I think we would all agree that we should try to do everything we can to correct disinformation and to address it, but how do you identify it? How do you do it in a way that's totally consistent with the First Amendment? That's one big issue. A second one is when that disinformation is coming from our political leaders, how is it that we address that? How can we respond to it effectively? And then a third that I think is really a challenging issue is, you know, the president was deplatformed, a word that I don't think any of us knew existed until pretty recently, from Twitter and other social media in the last week. They're private companies. They're not subject to the First Amendment. So there's not a First Amendment issue there. At the same time, though, you know, those who say that this raises a First Amendment issue, while technically, legally, it doesn't, there is no question that those have become vital communication platforms. And, you know, although the percentage of people who use Twitter may not be enormous like it is with Facebook, it certainly drives media coverage and a lot of other communication. And, you know, part of what I think is going on there is a feeling that those companies are acting in a lot of ways like a utility. They are so commonly used by people that if you are excluded from them, it almost feels like an infringement on your rights, even though it's a private company acting rather than the government. I personally think that the decisions with respect to President Trump were the correct ones, and that deplatforming him as well as others who've been spreading conspiracy theories is the right choice. But I think we've got to engage with these issues because, you know, having some sort of construct that we feel like isn't going to give Twitter or Facebook a huge amount of power over our political discourse by choosing which voices that they want to amplify and which ones they want to silence. You know, I think that's an important issue for our democracy. And, you know, figuring out how we address that going forward, I think, is an important debate to have.
Attorney McNeely, you want
to? Well, I mean, there's nothing more to add to that. I think what Attorney Call explained is perfect. I think from our perspective, though, there's always an argument, right? We understand what the precedent is and what the, you know, the analysis might be in order to assess whether or not someone engaged in that conduct and can be held liable under the law. But I think what made Thurgood Marshall such a great attorney was you know, looking at that established structure and saying, well, this is how I'm going to challenge it. Or these are some new facts we're going to add here. And I think that that's going to help us moving forward with the president and deciding what we're going to do in order to kind of met through that liability. But I thought Attorney Call made a great point. You know, this is the first time in history where we're looking at the President of the United States, you know, doing all of this. Most of our history, the case law precedent is for, you know, more private individuals. And I think political speech has a lot more protection. You can lie about your candidate, you know, your opponents and kind of get away with that more so under the interest of freedom of speech, from what I understand. And so it's a little different in this political arena, but I think we're going to have to, as a country, decide where we want to be with this. And I think moving forward, things could change, and we might have to add to that analysis and what incitement means and what some of these other categories of protected speech and non-protected speech, how they met out.
That's attorney Lynette McNeely from the Wisconsin Conference of the NAACP. And before that, we heard from Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call and UW Stout professor and author Timothy Scheel. Today on the West Side, we're playing excerpts from a panel discussion about race, civility, and the First Amendment from Monday's Martin Luther King Remembrance event for the Chippewa Valley. Coming up, we hear what the panelists had to say about the balance between free speech and racial harassment. I'm Dean Kallenbach. This is The West Side on the Ideas Network. We're back on The West Side, featuring today excerpts from Monday's Martin Luther King Remembrance in the Chippewa Valley, a program that included a panel discussion on race, civility, and the First Amendment. The panel took a question about racial harassment and free speech from the online audience. UW Eau Claire political scientist Eric Casper was first to respond, followed by attorney Lynette McNeely of the NAACP, then by UW Stout professor and author Timothy Scheel.
It's a difficult problem to grapple with, especially the last question about when we have the situation where someone says something that may be untrue or we can interpret as false. Who makes that determination? And what do we do with hyperbole? Another famous case, Watts versus the United States from 1969, where it was someone who was a draft eligible in the presence of an Army investigator said he wouldn't submit to military conscription. And instead, he utters this line. He says that he's not going to Vietnam. And if they ever make him carry a rifle, the first person he wants to get in his sights was LBJ, right? And he's prosecuted for this. And the Supreme Court overturns that conviction, talking about how within our speech, there is often a political hyperbole. And how the language of the political arena is, it's often inexact, it's often abusive, but it's necessary to allow that to go on so that we don't have someone who is either misinterpreted in terms of what they're saying, or you have those who are in power are trying to silence dissenters or their political opponents. And so I think, it's a difficult line, right? Because on the other hand, I mean, there is real danger of people intentionally spreading misinformation, particularly online. But how do we, how do we deal with that when I think the turning this into a situation where the government becomes the arbiter of truth on a generalized question like that, outside of a specific instance talking about a specific person, where you get into questions of slander and libel, and we have well-established legal standards about what that means. I think there is a big danger there. It's part of the reason why nothing's been done in any comprehensive way since what we've been seeing over the last several years in terms of that disinformation online. How do we do it in a way that we don't create a larger problem than what we're seeing?
So yeah, the line for racial harassment, I find it intriguing. Going back to my opening statements about that history of denying a whole group of people access to the privileges of America, in order to do that successfully, there had to be some lies and a lot of untruths being pushed through the public ether, right? In order for us to have an American eugenic society, you had to have some lying there about the inferiority of others. And in order for us to have sustaining the Jim Crow laws as we have, you had to firmly lie about, someone's intelligence ability, or paying someone who's African-American less as the law of the land up until 1968. You had to believe the lie that certain people were, or Blacks, were not as intelligent or couldn't have the ability. So we've been dealing with this issue as a race of people, I guess, called African Americans for a while, understanding how lies could impact not only your livelihood, your neighborhood, your access to opportunities. And I think that now the rest of the America is looking at how impactful lies can be, perhaps. So I think looking and parsing through that history a lot more than we have is going to be key to deciding how what we need to do today, or what really are dangerous issues and dangerous problems, and how they can have a dangerous impact on people, and being clear that it's not hyperbole when you can destroy an entire neighborhood with your comments. When it comes to social media, it's so impactful, right? When it comes to the political arena and social media, it's so impactful. So we can't just rely on that history and say, well, this is the way we've done it, and so we're gonna do it this way now. We should stop, think, reassess. Now, when it comes to racial harassment in the line, I think, what was the question you asked? I really want to answer or hit on.
Is there a line? What's the line between racial harassment and free speech?
Harassment and free speech. So once again, I think if you just look at today, someone calling, person A calling person B a racial slur, and just, not looking beyond that, the protections are there for that conduct. You have a freedom to think what you want to think, to say what you want to say. I know the first cases I had out of law school were misdemeanor disorderly conducts, where my client was called the N-word and beat somebody up for it. And it was clear that he was not, my time. So
that's like, that's the right response, but okay.
And I thought that was intriguing, that's true. We all kind of heard that growing up, because as in a community that's marginalized, you don't have the privilege of the police helping you or someone in leadership helping you resolve your problems. You will be let alone to deal with, some aggressions against you. And so, the response I think I see, especially in Milwaukee, was you have to, step up and do what you need to do in order to get some respect in that moment. You're not going to be able to get the teachers, support. You're not going to be able to get the police to come in to support you. And even if anyone does support you, they too get punished for being on your side. So you end up creating this culture around, marginalized folks, where you have to, if you don't stand up for yourself, no one will, right? But now today, in that space, when you're in court, if someone calls you the N-word and you get aggressive, the courts have found reason to charge you criminally for that. And so the message needs to get out there. That's not the proper response. And I'm not saying I support what the court did or I do not support it, but I think it's important to understand that, we've been keeping marginalized groups of people outside of this conversation, outside of the progress of, some other people who are status quo in the States. But then we bring them in and subject them to the rules. And I think when it comes to this history of freedom of speech, that entitlement of the status quo community to say whatever they wanted to say, to be protected by the laws, to have support and not have their supporters demonized, creates a different culture around that dynamic, right? When it comes to marginalized folks, do they have the freedom to speak out? I mean, did my client have a freedom to express himself when he was called the N-word? No. We have these constructs and ways to keep that person further marginalized, right? I find it fascinating that this doesn't get out more. This isn't talked about more, It's like we conveniently ignore how we've treated other, huge swaths of communities of people. And then we have a conversation about the Bill of Rights. We talk about a communist from 1937 who's African-American, but we gloss over the fact that he was subject to Jim Crow rules, right? And why aren't we hearing more about African-Americans who, exercise their First Amendment rights? Because there was Jim Crow, right? Once again, having that honest conversation about our history and bringing this dialogue back so that we can reanalyze it, including that history that we've been ignoring, I think is going to be really important. So the answer, what is racial harassment, what's the line? I don't know. But I think that we do need to rethink our first approach to that, our first answer to that question.
Well, great points there. And just to follow up on a couple of the different lines going on here. So the line between protected expression and racial harassment, I think it's misleading to say there is a line. There's some kind of clear line that distinguishes the two. It's very context dependent, and courts have to look at the totality of facts in any case to make any judgment. So it's hard to say, well, this will do it, or that'll do it, or just this one thing will do it. It's usually a combination of factors. And it also depends on the context. So there's definitions in employment and education for racial harassment that wouldn't apply for an interaction on the street in a public square, or that would apply in a private store or something like that. So the First Amendment is very complicated, and there's so many different factors to take into account that might be good or bad. But this comes to another point that Attorney McNeely raised, and that is the First Amendment evolves, and that's a good thing. First Amendment today looks nothing like what the First Amendment looked like 100 years ago or even 50 years ago. It's constantly changing and adapting to social circumstances. That's not always a good thing. Sometimes it changes for the worse, and we could have another panel someday to talk about some of the changes we don't agree with, but it's important to remember that the First Amendment is not set in stone, and the rules we have for today aren't laid down in, you know, as the Ten Commandments or something, right? So to be open to those debates and to have those discussions is really important. I just want to second that idea. I also want to second her idea about there's some more attention, fortunately, being given to disparities and the ability to speak and the platforms you can speak in and what the social costs of speaking out might be. That's always been weighted very heavily against people of color. And so this is one of my worries about civility. Civility can be very elitist and very racist. And, you know, Jim Crow thought civility was one thing, and I vehemently disagree with their conception of civility. And I'm glad that people were uncivil in reacting to Jim Crow. And there's other contexts where I probably would be a big fan of incivility too, but incivility isn't violence. Incivility isn't violence.
That was the voice of panelist Timothy Scheel, director of the Menard Center for the Study of Institutions and Innovation at UW-Stout and author of the book African Americans and the First Amendment. Speaking just before him was Lynette McNeely, chair of legal redress for the Wisconsin Conference of the NAACP of UW-Stout. And the first person to speak in that segment was political science professor Eric Casper, director of UW-Eau Claire's Menard Center for Constitutional Studies. Earlier in the show, we heard from Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call and UW-Eau Claire Interim Vice Chancellor for Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion, Teresa O'Halloran. We've been listening to excerpts from a panel discussion held Monday as part of the Chippewa Valley's Martin Luther King Day Remembrance Program on the topic of race, civility, and the First Amendment. Moderator for the event was Latrice Donaldson. She's an assistant professor of history at UW-Stout. The MLK Remembrance was part of a partnership with the Pablo Center at the Confluence, Converge Radio, Uniting Bridges of the Chippewa Valley, UW-Stout, UW-Eau Claire, Chippewa Valley Technical Colleges, and the cities of Eau Claire and Altoona. If you'd like to hear the entire event, all 8 hours are available at facebook.com/kingremembrance. We'll have a link in our website at wpr.org/western. Thanks to A.J. Moen and Justin Anderson for audio production, and to the event organizers, Salika Duxworth-Lawton, Ed Hudgens, and Adam Akala. Next week on the West Side, we're back with live guests to talk about the economy of Western Wisconsin in the midst of winter and in the midst of a pandemic. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Dean Kallenbach. Be well. This is the West Side on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.